This is WA3QIZ. Do you read me?
Seymour, isn't it about time you made a real friend?
Mother, please, I'm communicating with my fellow hams.
How do I talk? Push this button here. You're all losers!
My name is Celeste from Catskill, New York, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Field recordings, found sound, soundscapes, ambience.
Bells, bugs,
whispers, and plinks.
Hosted by
Stephen Bradley
and Edward Rahelstreet.
Every fifth Tuesday of the month from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m.
Bells, bugs, whispers, and plinks.
On WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC.org.
Columbia County Sanctuary Movement is a nonprofit organization based in Columbia County that organizes alongside immigrants and allies to collectively support, empower, and defend our communities. CCSM offers programs that assist newly arrived individuals, including food programs, mutual aid funds, legal support services, and opportunities to organize and be an activist. You can find more information on social media at CCSMNY or by calling 518-3...
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, it's 12:02 a.m. It's the first day of December in the last month of 2025 CE. I believe that means it's Christian era. Maybe it means it's a civilized epic. Maybe it means it's a cultivated ecology. Anyways, it's a metric just as good as any other of fiction made true and even real in some people's mind. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas, on WGXC 90.7 FM, community radio for open ears, broadcasting to you live from the Hudson Valley of the Empire State, New York. I could be sitting here with the Christmas tree, with the toys and the ornaments all around, the fireplace crackling, the snowflakes dripping softly from the overstuffed gutters under the roof. I could be. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. I do understand that there is, if you're up this way, snow accumulation predicted Tuesday. But that's not my job. WGXC Radio is a nonprofit radio. It's run by all kinds of people in the community. Democrats, Republicans, communists, anarchists, socialists, even utopists like me. Christians, Muslims, Jews, atheists, agnostics. All the various gender benders, the youth, the not so young, the no longer young, the not quite old, the elders, and the elderlies, the skinny, the obese, the fit, the scraping by, the workers, essential and otherwise, garbage collectors, nurses, moms, dads, deadbeats, bums, they're all there. Not everybody's telling their stories, so I won't. But here's one. This one by Lydia Davis. My go-to. When the book I intended to read was inserted into the washing machine, unbeknownst by me. By a household member who remained nameless. Lydia Davis's story from the collected stories of Lydia Davis, The House Plans. The land was pointed out to me from the road, which ran along the side of the hill above it, and right away I wanted to buy it. If the agent had spoken to me of disadvantages, I would not have heard him at that moment. I was numbed by the beauty of what I saw, a long valley of blood-red vineyards, half flooded with late summer rain. In the distance, yellow fields, choked with weeds and thistles, and behind them a forest covering a hillside. In the middle of the valley, higher than the fields, the ruin of a farmhouse. A mulberry tree grew up through the broken stone of its garden wall, and nearby the shadow of an ancient pear tree lay across the carpet of brown, rotted fruit on the ground. Leaning against his car, the agent said, "There's one room left intact. Inside, it is filthy. They have had animals there for years." We walked down to the house. Dung was thick on the tiles of the floor. I felt the wind through the stones. I saw daylight through the lofty roof. None of this discouraged me. I had the papers drawn up that same day. I looked forward for so many years to finding a piece of land and building a house on it that I sometimes felt I had not been brought into the world for any other purpose. Once the desire was born in me, all my energies were bent on satisfying it. The job that I got as soon as I could leave school was tiresome and demoralizing, but it brought me more and more money as my responsibilities grew. In order to spend as little as possible, I lived a very uneventful life and resisted making friends or enjoying myself. After many years, I had enough money to leave my job and begin looking for land. Real estate agents drove me from one property to another. I saw so many pieces of land that I grew confused and no longer knew just what I was looking for. When at last the valley came into sight below me, I felt I had been relieved of a terrible burden. Pardon me. While the warmth of summer lay over the land, I was content. Living in my majestic and soot blackened room, I cleaned it up, filled it with furniture, and set up a drawing board in one corner where I worked on plans for rebuilding the house. Looking up from my work, I would see the sunlight on the olive leaves and be lured outdoors. Walking over the grass by the house, I watched with the tired, expectant eyes of a man who has lived all his life in the city. Magpies running through the thyme and lizards vanishing into the wall. In stormy weather, the cypresses by my window bent before the wind. Then the autumn chill came down and hunters stalked near my house. The explosion of their rifles filled me with dread. Pipes from a sewage treatment yard in the next field cracked and let a terrible smell into the air. I built fires in my fireplace and was never warm. One day my window was darkened by the form of a young hunter. The man was wearing leather and carrying a rifle. After looking at me for a moment, he came to my door and opened it without knocking. He stood in the shadow of the door and stared at me. His eyes were milky blue, and his reddish beard hardly concealed his skin. I immediately took him for a half-wit and was terrified. He did nothing. After gazing at what was in the room, he shut the door behind him and went away. I was filled with rage, as though we were strolling around a zoo. This man had come up to my stony little pen and rudely examined me. I fumed and paced around the room, but I was lonely there, out in the country, and he had awakened my curiosity. By the time a few days had gone by, I was anxious to see him. He came again, and this time he did not hesitate at the door, but walked in, sat down on a chair, and spoke to me. I didn't understand his country accent. He repeated one phrase twice and then a third time, and still I could only guess at his meaning. When I tried to answer him, he had the same trouble understanding my city accent. I gave up and offered him a glass of wine. He refused it. In a diffident sort of way, he got up from his chair and ventured to inspect my belongings at closer range. Proceeding from my bookcase around the walls, which were covered with framed prints of houses I particularly liked, some in the Place des Vosges and some in the poor quarters behind Montparnasse, he finally arrived at my drawing board, where he stopped short and stood with his finger in the air, waiting for enlightenment. The fact that I was planning a house line by line took him a long while to understand, and when he did, he began tracing the walls of each room with his finger, a few inches above the blueprint. When at last he had examined and traced every line, he smiled at me without parting his lips, looking sideways in a rather sly way that I did not understand, and abruptly left. Again, I was angry, feeling that he had invaded my room and stolen my secrets. Yet when my anger subsided, I wanted him to return. He returned the following day, and a few days later he came yet again, though the wind was high. I began to expect him and look forward to his visits. He hunted every morning, very early, and several times in the week. After he was finished, he would walk in from the field where the sun was beginning to color the white clay. His face would gleam, and he would be so full of energy that he could hardly contain it. Leaping up every few minutes from his chair, he would pace to the door and look out, return to the middle of the room, whistling tunelessly, and sit down again. Slowly this energy would die away, and when it was gone, he would go too. He never accepted anything to eat or drink, and seemed surprised that I would offer it, as though sharing food and drink were an act of great intimacy. It did not become any easier for us to communicate, but we found more and more things to do together. He helped me prepare for winter by filling the chinks in my walls and stacking wood for the fireplace. After we had worked, we could go out into the fields and the forest. My friend showed me the places he liked to visit, a grove of hawthorns, a rabbit warren, and a cave in the hillside. And though I had only one thing that I could show him, he seemed to find it just as mysterious and absorbing as I did. Each time he came to see me, we would first go over to my blueprint, where I had added another room or increased the size of my study. There were always changes to show him, because I was never done improving my plan and worked on it almost every hour. Sometimes, now, he would pick up my pencil and awkwardly sketch in something that would not have occurred to me, a smokehouse, a root cellar. But the excitement of the plan, as well as the pleasure of having a friend, were blinding me to a dreadful fact. The longer I lived on my land, letting time slip by, the more the possibility of building the house faded. My money was trickling away, and my dream was going with it. In the village, far from any marketplace, the price of food was double what it had been in the city. Thin as I was, I could not eat any less. Good masons and carpenters, even poor ones, were rare and expensive here. To hire a pair of them for a few months would leave me too little to live on afterwards. I did not give up when I learned this, but I had no answers to the questions that plagued me. In the beginning, my blueprint had absorbed all my time and attention because I was going to build the house from it. Gradually, the blueprint became more vivid to me than the actual house. In my imagination, I spent more and more time among the penciled lines that shifted at my will. Yet, if I had openly admitted that there was no longer any possibility of building this house, the blueprint would have lost its meaning. So I continued to believe in the house, while all the time the possibility of building it eroded steadily from under my belief. What made the situation all the more frustrating was that on the outskirts of the village, new houses were springing up every few months. When I had bought the land, the only structures in the valley were stone field huts. Squatting in the middle of each plowed field, they were as black as caves inside with floors of earth. After signing the deed, I had returned home and stood, well satisfied, looking across the acres of abandoned vineyards and overgrown farmland to the horizon, where the village sat piled up on a small hill like a castle, with its church steeples clustered at the top. Now, here and there on the landscape, there was a wound of raw red earth, and in a few weeks a new house would rise like a scab above it. There was no time for the landscape to absorb these changes. Hardly had one house been finished before the live oaks were felled right and left for another. I watched the progress of one house with particular horror and misgiving, because it was within a few minutes' walk of my own. The deliberate speed with which it went up shook me and seemed a mockery of my own situation. It was an ugly house with pink walls and cheap iron grillwork over the windows. Once it was finished and the last young tree planted in the dust beside it, the owners drove up from the city and spent All Saints' Day there, sitting on the terrace and looking out over the valley as though they had box seats at the opera. After that, as long as the weather held, they drove up to the house every weekend, filling the countryside with the noise of their radio. I watched them gloomily from my window. The worst of it was that my friend immediately stopped visiting me on the weekends. I knew he had been drawn away from me by neighbors. From a distance, I saw him standing quietly among them in their yard. I felt utterly miserable. At last, I had to admit how bleak my position was. It occurred to me then to sell my land and begin all over again somewhere else. I thought I might get a good price for the land from other city people, but when I went to see the real estate agent, he told me flatly that because there was a sewage yard in the next field and because my house was uninhabitable, my property would be almost impossible to sell. He went on to say that the only people who might be interested in buying it were my neighbors, who had, in fact, resented my presence all this time and would give a very low sum for the land just to be rid of me. I was shocked. My strongest feeling, of course, was that I would never sell to my neighbors. I would never give them that triumph. I turned my back on the agent and left without saying a word. As I stood deliberating on the doorstep, I heard him go into another room, say something to his wife, and laugh loudly. This was a very low point in my life. When, after several weeks, my friend stopped coming altogether, without a word to explain his absence, my bitterness was complete. I sank into a deep depression and decided that I would give up the idea of building a house and return to my job in the city. The directors of my company had not been able to find anyone else willing to put up with the long hours and devote himself to such interminable complications. They had several times written asking me to return and offering me more money. I could easily slip back into my old way of life, I thought. This stay in the country would then have been a protracted holiday. I even managed to convince myself for a moment that I missed city life and my few acquaintances in the office who used to buy me drinks after particularly tedious days. I told the agent to make an offer to my neighbors and tried to think that I was doing the right thing, but my heart was not in the move, and I felt like a changed man as I packed up my belongings and took a last walk around my narrow boundaries. The suitcases were out in the early sunlight before the door of the house. The taxi I had hired was bumping over the dirt toward me, and I was really on the point of leaving when I thought it might have been too hasty. It would be wrong to go without saying anything to the young man who had been my friend, whose name I did not even know. I paid off the driver and told him to come at the same hour the following day. He gave me a doubtful look and drove back down the road. The dust swirled up behind him and settled. I carried my suitcases inside and sat down. After I had spent some time wondering how to find my friend, I realized that, of course, I had been foolish, that I had pointlessly committed myself to one more day in these hostile surroundings, that I would not be able to find him. The directors would be annoyed when I did not arrive at the office. They would worry about me and make an attempt to reach me and would be completely at a loss when they did not succeed. As the morning advanced, I became more and more restless and angry with myself and felt that I had made a terrible mistake. It was small comfort to know that on the following day everything would go forward as planned and that, in the end, it would seem as though this day had never passed at all. During that long, hot afternoon, small birds fluttered in the thorny brush, and a sweet smell rose from the earth. The sky was without clouds. The sun cast black shadows over the ground. I sat in my business suit by the wall of the house and was not touched by the beauty of the land. My thoughts were in the city, and my imprisonment in the country chafed me. At supper time, there was nothing to eat, but I was not willing to walk to the village. I lay awake, cold and hungry, for hours before falling asleep. I awoke before sunrise. I was so hungry that I felt I had stones in my stomach, and I looked forward to eating some breakfast at the train station. Everything outside my window was black. Gusts of wind began moving the leaves as the sky became white behind the black bushes. Color slowly came into the leaves. In the forest and closer to the house, bird songs rose and fell on all sides. I listened very intently to them. When the rays of sunlight reached the bushes, I went outside and sat by the house. When at last the taxi came, I felt so peaceful that I could not bring myself to leave. After some angry words, the driver went away. Throughout the morning and into the afternoon, I sat in my business suit beside the house as I had sat the day before, but I was no longer impatient or eager to be somewhere. I was absorbed and watching what passed before me, birds disappearing into the bushes, bugs crawling around stones, as though I were invisible, as though I were watching it all in my own absence, or being where I should not be, where no one expected me to be, I was a mere shadow of myself, lagging behind for an instant, caught in the light. Soon the strap would tighten, and I would be gone, flying in pursuit of myself. For the moment, I was at liberty. When evening came, I did not know I was hungry. Lightheaded with contentment, I continued to sit still, waiting. Driven inside by the cold and the darkness, I lay down and had savage dreams. The next morning, I saw a figure at the far edge of the nearest field walking very slowly across. My eyes felt as if a long emptiness had been filled. Pardon me. Without knowing it, I had been waiting for my friend. But as I watched him, his hesitation began to seem unnatural, and then it frightened me. He weaved back and forth over the furrows, put his nose up as though sniffing the air like a spaniel, and did not seem to know where he was going. I started to meet him, and as I drew closer, I saw that his forehead was wrapped in bandages and that the skin of his face was an awful color of gray. When I came up to him, he was bewildered and stared at me as though I were a stranger. I took him by the arm and helped him over the ground. When we reached the house, he pushed me aside and lay down on my bed. He was trembling with exhaustion. He had lost so much flesh that his cheeks were like pits and his hands were like claws. He had such fever in his eyes that I thought wildly of going to the village for a doctor. But after his breath had returned to him, he began speaking quite tranquilly. He explained something at great length while I sat uncomprehending by the bed and listened. He made several motions with his arms, and finally I realized he had been in a hunting accident. During all the weeks that I had been reproaching him so bitterly, he had been lying in a hospital somewhere. He continued to talk on, and I found it hard to concentrate on what he said. I became restless and impatient. After a while, I could not bear it any longer. I got up and paced stiffly back and forth in the room. At last, he stopped speaking and pointed to one corner of the room under the window. I did not understand because there was nothing there but the window. Then I saw that he was trying to point to the drawing board which had been dismantled and that he wanted to see my blueprint. I unpacked it and gave it to him. Still, he was unsatisfied. I found a pencil in my pocket and gave it to him, too. He began drawing on the blueprint. After a short time, he had covered the entire page out to its edges with complicated forms. Standing over him and staring, at last I recognized a tower and what might have been a doorway among the tangle of lines. When he had filled the page, I gave him more sheets of paper, and he continued to work. His hand hardly paused, and what he drew had the complexity of something concealed and worked over during many solitary days. When he was too tired to move the pencil any longer, he fell asleep. I left him there in the early evening and went to the village for food. Returning across the fields to my house, I looked at the red landscape and felt that it was deeply familiar to me, as though it had been mine long before I found it. The idea of leaving it seemed to make no sense at all. Within a few days, my rage and disappointment had ebbed away. And now, as in the beginning, each thing I looked at seemed only a shell or a husk that would fall away and reveal a perfect bulk. Although I was tired, my mind raced forward. I cleared a patch of land by the house, and I put up a stable there. I led black and white cows into it, and nervous hens ran underfoot. I planted a line of cypress trees on the edge of my property, and it hid my neighbor's house. I pulled down the ruined walls, and with the same stones, raised my own manor. And when it was finished, I looked upon a spectacle that would excite the envy of everyone who saw it. My dream would be realized as it was first meant to be. I might have been delirious. It was not likely that things would end that way, but as I stumbled over the last sinking, as I stumbled over the field, sorry, sinking deep into a furrow with one step and rising to a crest with the next. I was too happy to suspect that at any moment my frustrations and disappointments, like a cloud of locusts, would darken the sky and descend on me again. The evening was serene, the light smooth and soft. The earth paralyzed, and I, far below, the only moving creature. That was Lydia Davis. I guess, I don't know, you know. I feel like she's an amazing writer. Anyways, this is WGXC 90.7 FM. You're listening to your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night, Norman. It is Sunday. I mean, it is Monday now. Monday, the first day of December, and 12:31. 31 minutes into the day. Here on Good Night, Norman, I read fiction. That's about all I do. And try to stay awake. Also, WGXC is a nonprofit. You can send some money to WGXC by going to the WGXC.org website and scrolling down, hitting the donate button. There it'll give you various options to donate monthly, daily, weekly, every hour, on the hour, or as you please. There's a special intravenous attachment for healthy donors to submit blood and also coolers in which one may place one's firstborn, but only if still infantile. Your contributions, donations, and blood offerings help to maintain WGXC as a community radio station without commercial interruption of any kind other than this one, begging you for money, and I suppose other public service announcement type things. But yeah, not any big box stores. Well, that may be fun. I've always kind of wanted to be a television radio announcer. Or a documentary narrator, you know, that kind of thing. And obviously, to make millions and millions from the rubes. I want to read a couple more of these. I can't say that I can imagine a better book for you to read than this one. The Bone by Lydia Davis, from her collected stories. Many years ago, my husband and I were living in Paris and translating art books. Whatever money we made, we spent on movies and food. We went mostly to old American movies, which were very popular there, and we ate out a lot of the time because restaurant meals were cheap then, and neither of us knew how to cook very well. One night, though, I cooked some fillets of fish for dinner. These fillets were not supposed to contain bones, and yet there must have been a small bone in one of them because my husband swallowed it and it got caught in his throat. This had never happened to either of us before, though we had always worried about it. I gave him bread to eat, and he drank many glasses of water, but the bone was really stuck and didn't move. After several hours in which the pain intensified and my husband and I grew more and more uneasy, we left the apartment and walked out into the dark streets of Paris to look for help. We were first directed to the ground floor apartment of a nurse who lived not far away. She then directed us to a hospital. We walked on some way and found the hospital in the Rue de Vaugirard. It was old and quite dark, as though it didn't do much business anymore. Inside, I waited on a folding chair in a wide hallway near the front entrance, while my husband sat behind a closed door nearby in the company of several nurses who wanted to help him but could not do more than spray his throat, then stand back and laugh. And he would laugh, too, as best he could. I didn't know what they were all laughing about. Finally, a young doctor came and took my husband and me down several long deserted corridors and around two sides of the dark hospital grounds to an empty wing containing another examining room in which he kept his special instruments. Each instrument had a different angle of curvature, but they all ended in some sort of a hook. Under a single pool of light in the darkened room, he inserted one instrument after another down my husband's throat, working with fierce interest and enthusiasm. Every time he inserted another instrument, my husband gagged and waved his hands in the air. At last, the doctor drew out the little fishbone and showed it around proudly. The three of us smiled and congratulated one another. The doctor took us back down the empty corridors and out under the vaulted entryway that had been built to accommodate horse-drawn carriages. We stood there and talked a little, looking around at the empty streets of the neighborhood. Then we shook hands and my husband and I walked home. More than 10 years have passed since then, and my husband and I have gone our separate ways. But every now and then, when we are together, we remember that young doctor. A great Jewish doctor, says my husband, who is also Jewish. All right, this is another by Lydia Davis. It'll probably get us out the other side of the show. Lydia Davis from a collected stories collection. How about that? And I'm going to read it. My name, Norman Douglas. This show, Goodnight Norman, radio station WGXC.org on the worldwide interweb. A few things wrong with me. He said there were things about me that he hadn't liked from the very beginning. He didn't say this unkindly. He's not an unkind person, at least not intentionally. He said it because I was trying to get him to explain why he changed his mind about me so suddenly. I may ask his friends what they think about this, because they know him better than I do. They've known him for more than 15 years, whereas I've known him for only about 10 months. I like them, and they seem to like me, though we don't know each other very well. What I want to do is to have a meal or a drink with at least two of them and talk about him until I begin to get a better picture of him. It's easy to come to the wrong conclusions about people. I see now that all these past months I kept coming to the wrong conclusions about him. For example, when I thought he would be unkind to me, he was kind. Then, when I thought he would be effusive, he was merely polite. When I thought he would be annoyed to hear my voice on the telephone, he was pleased. And when I thought he would turn against me because I had treated him rather coldly, he was more anxious than ever to be with me and went to great trouble and expense so that we could spend a little time together. Then, when I made up my mind that he was the man for me, he suddenly called the whole thing off. Well, it seemed sudden to me, even though for the last month I could feel him drawing away. For instance, he didn't write as often as he had before, and then when we were together, he said more unkind things to me than he ever had before. When he left, I knew he was thinking it over. He took a month to think it over, and I knew it was 50-50. He would come to the point of saying what he did. I suppose it seemed sudden because of the hopes I had for him and me by then, and the dreams I had about us, some of the usual dreams about a nice house and nice babies, the two of us together in the house working in the evening while the babies were asleep, then some other dreams about how we would travel together, about how I'd learn to play the banjo or the mandolin so that I could play with him because he has a lovely tenor voice. Now, when I picture myself playing the banjo or the mandolin, the idea seems silly. The way it all ended was that he called me up on a day he didn't usually call me and said he had finally come to a decision. Then he said that because he had trouble figuring it all this out, he had made some notes about what he was going to say, and he asked me if I would mind if he read them. I said I would mind very much. He said he would at least have to look at them now and then as he talked. Then he talked in a very reasonable way about how bad the chances were for us to be happy together and about changing over to a friendship now before it was too late. I said he was talking to me as though I were an old tire that might have blown out down the highway. He thought that was funny. We talked about how he had felt about me at various times and how I had felt about him at various times, and it seemed that these feelings hadn't matched very well. Then, when I wanted to know exactly how he had felt about me from the very beginning, trying to find out, really, what was the most he had ever felt, he made this very plain statement about how there were things about me that he hadn't liked from the very beginning. He wasn't trying to be unkind, but just very clear. I told him I wouldn't ask him what these things were, but I knew I would have to go and think about it. I didn't like hearing there were things about me that bothered him. It was shocking to hear that someone I loved had never liked certain things about me. Of course, there were a few things I didn't like about him, too. For instance, an affectation in his manner involving the introduction of foreign phrases into conversation. But although I had noticed these things, I never said it to him in quite this way. But if I try to be logical, I have to think that after all, there may be a few things wrong with me. Then the problem is to figure out what these things are. For several days after we talked, I tried to think about this, and I came up with some possibilities. Maybe I didn't talk enough. I'm not very talkative, or at least not in the way he probably likes. I have some good ideas from time to time, but not much information. I can talk for a long time only when it's about something boring. Maybe I talk too much about which foods he should be eating. I worry about the way people eat and tell them what they should eat, which is a tiresome thing to do, something my ex-husband never liked either. Maybe I mentioned my ex-husband too often so that he thought my ex-husband was still on my mind, which wasn't true. He might have been irritated by the fact that he couldn't kiss me in the street for fear of getting poked in the eye by my glasses, or maybe he didn't even like being with a woman who wore glasses. Maybe he didn't like always having to look in my eyes through this blue-tinted glass. Or maybe he doesn't like people who write things on index cards, diet plans on little index cards, plot summaries on big index cards. I don't like it much myself, and I don't do it all the time. It's just a way I have of trying to get my life in order. But he might have come across some of those index cards. I couldn't think of much else that would have bothered him from the very beginning. Then I decided I would never be able to think of the things about me that bothered him. Whatever I thought of him would probably not be the same things. And anyway, I wasn't going to go on trying to identify these things, because even if I knew what they were, I wouldn't be able to do anything about them. Late in the conversation, he tried to tell me how excited he was about his new plan for the summer. Now that he wasn't going to be with me, he thought he would travel down to Venezuela to visit some friends who were doing anthropological work in the jungle. I told him I didn't want to hear about that. While we talked on the phone, I was drinking some wine left over from a large party I'd given. After we hung up, I immediately picked up the phone again and made a new series of phone calls. And while I talked, I finished one of the leftover bottles of wine and started on another that was sweeter than the first, then finished that one too. First, I called a few people here in the city. Then, when it got too late for that, I called a few people in California. When it got too late to go on calling California, I called someone in England who had just woken up and was not in a very good mood. Between one phone call and the next, I would sometimes walk by the window and look up at the moon, which was in its first quarter, but remarkably bright. And I'd think of him, and then I'd wonder when I would stop thinking of him every time I saw the moon. The reason I thought of him when I saw the moon was that during the first 5 days and four nights, he and I were first together. The moon was waxing and then full. The nights were clear. We were in the country where you notice the sky more. And every night, early or late, we would walk outdoors together, partly to get away from the various members of our families who were in the house, and partly just to take pleasure in the meadows and the woods under the moonlight. The dirt road that slipped up away from the house into the woods was full of ruts and rocks, so that we kept stumbling against each other and more tightly into each other's arms. We talked about how nice it would be to bring a bed out into the meadow and lie down on it in the moonlight. In the moonlight. The next time the moon was full, I was back in the city, and I saw it out the window of a new apartment. I thought to myself that a month had passed since he and I were together, and that it had passed very slowly. After that, every time the moon was full, shining on the leafy tall trees in the backyards here and on the flat tar roofs, then on to the bare trees and slowly ground in the winter. Then on the bare trees. Oh, wait a minute. I missed that whole paragraph. After that, every time the moon was full, shining on the leafy tall trees in the backyards here, and on the flat tar roofs, and then on the bare trees and snowy ground in the winter, I would think to myself that another month had passed, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I like counting the months that way. He and I always seemed to be counting the time as it passed and waiting for it to pass so that the day would come when we would be together again. This was one reason he said he couldn't go on with it. And maybe he's right. It isn't too late. We will change over to a friendship, and he will talk to me now and then long distance, mostly about his work or my work, and give me good advice or a plan of action when I need one, then call himself something like my Aminos Grise. When I stopped making my phone calls, I was too dizzy to go to sleep. This was because of the wine. So I turned on the television and watched some police dramas, some old sitcoms, and finally a show about unusual people across the country. I turned the set off at 5 in the morning when the sky was light, and I fell asleep right away. It's true that by the time the night was over, I wasn't worrying anymore about what was wrong with me. At that hour of the morning, I can usually get myself out to the end of something like a long dock with water all around where I'm not touched by such worries. But there will always come a time later that day or a day or two after when I ask myself that difficult question once or over and over again, a useless question, really, since I'm not the one who can answer it. And anyone else who tries will come up with a different answer, though of course all the answers together may add up to the right one, if there's such a thing as a right answer to a question like that. Lydia Davis, as read by me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM, Community Radio for Open Ears. Bruh. Okay, one last tale from Lydia Davis from her collected stories. This one, Two Sisters. Though everyone wishes it would not happen, and though it would be far better if it did not happen, it does sometimes happen that a second daughter is born, and there are two sisters. Of course, any daughter crying in the hour of her birth is only a failure, and is greeted with a heavy heart by the father, since the man wanted sons. He tries again. Again, it is only a daughter. This is worse, for it is a second daughter. Then it is a third and even a fourth. He is miserable among females. He lives in despair with his failure. The man is lucky who has one son and one daughter, though his risk is great in trying for another son. Most fortunate is the man with sons only, for he can go on son after son until the daughter is made, and he will have all the sons he could wish for and a little daughter as well to grace his table. And if the daughter should never come, then he has a woman already in his wife, the mother of his sons. In himself he has not a man, only his wife has that man. She could wish for a daughter, having no woman, but her wishes are hardly audible, for she is herself a daughter, though she may have no living parents. The single daughter, the many brothers' only sister, listens to the voice of her family and is pleased with herself and happy. Her softness against her brother's brutality, her calm against their destruction, is admired. But when there are two sisters, one is uglier and more clumsy than the other. One is less clever. One is more promiscuous. Even when all the better qualities unite in one sister, as often happens, she will not be happy because the other, like a shadow, will follow her success with green eyes. Two sisters grow up at different times and despise each other for being such children. They quarrel and turn red. And though if there is only one daughter, she will remain Angela, two will lose their names and be stouter as a result. Two sisters often marry. One finds the husband of the other crude. The other uses her husband as a shield against her sister and her sister's husband when she fears for his quick wit. Though the two sisters attempt friendship so that their children will have cousins, they are often estranged. Their husbands disappoint them. Their sons are failures and spend their mother's love in cheap towns. Strong as iron only is now the hatred of the two sisters for each other. This endures as their husbands wither, their sons desert. As in leaving, not ice cream. Sorry, I had to make that editorial note. Apologies. Caged together, the two sisters contain their fury. Their features are the same. Two sisters in black shop for food together. Husbands dead. Sons died in some war. Their hatred is so familiar that they are unaware of it. They're sometimes tender with each other because they forget. But the faces of the two sisters in death are bitter by long habit. Two Sisters by Lydia Davis, from her collected stories, which I really, really love. And I probably recommended it before, even though I'm not really sure what the deal is, whether I'm supposed to recommend things I do or not. It's never clear to me, never been made clear to me. All right, well, you've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, right here on Good Night, Norman. Good Night, Norman is every first and third Monday of the month at midnight. Kind of a confusing time. Because it's not, I can't say it's the first and third Sunday, because it might not be the first and third Sunday. Like today, it's the first Monday, but yesterday was the last Sunday, and I don't really want to say that the show is on the last Sunday, so if you can remember that midnight is the beginning of the new day, then it's the first and third Monday of the month right here on WGXC.org and much of the electronic, electrified, electrocuted, electrocutie world. And if you have a radio with a tuner on it, maybe your car radio, WGXC 90.7 on the beautiful FM dial as you drive through the Hudson Valley from Hudson to Catskill. Tune on in, hear the weird sounds of nature breathing, hear the various types of music that are currently available to the American consumer. Hear political opinions that some people think are conservative and some people think are leftistic. You'll listen to them because they're there, not because I'm plugging any of them, because I don't really know what any of them are, because I don't really listen to political discourse or what passes for political discourse in this country. Unless, of course, it's utopian, which it rarely is. Which reminds me that recently someone, a hotel owner,